This show is sponsored by Liquid IV. It's been a pretty brutal winter for a lot of the country, but even where I am in Florida, I'm looking forward to that first really warm day of the year that keeps me outside for as long as possible. The one where the sun hits your skin and you feel like you can do anything and go anywhere. But don't let the past few months of hibernation lull you into forgetting that after being outside from sunrise to sunset, our bodies need some time to catch up with their desire to be on the move. I have some travel plans coming up. Maybe some of you have spring break on the horizon. Whether it's a three-day music festival, exploring a farmer's market, or a 12-hour flight to a destination wedding, just one stick of Liquid IV mixed into 16 ounces of water offers better hydration than water alone. Right now, you can get 20% off your first order with code FILMWEEKLY at checkout. It's been a while since I went to a proper music festival, but I would have loved to have Liquid IV with me when I was there because it's incredibly easy to tear open a packet, pour it into a thermos of water, stir it up, and feel like some of your life force is being restored when those electrolytes are replenished. I just tried the sugar-free mandarin orange flavor, and it's become my new favorite. Stay hydrated with on-the-go hydration from Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first purchase with code FILMWEEKLY at checkout. That's 20% off your first purchase with code FILMWEEKLY at liquidiv.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Weekly. It's Wednesday, March 4th, 2026. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the latest film and TV news. We'll have a conversation about Scream 7. We'll talk about Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie, and play an interview with director, co-writer, and co-star Matt Johnson. And we'll wrap up by having a chat about Pillion, and we'll play a conversation with that movie's star, Harry Melling, and director, Harry Lighton. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com. And boy, this weekly format is not necessarily super conducive to breaking news, but a day after our last episode released, Paramount stepped in and offered a higher price to Warner Brothers, who already had a written deal signed with Netflix, and Netflix had the legal right to match that offer, and instead Netflix declined to do that and just backed out of the whole deal entirely. So unless some wild thing ends up happening, it looks like Paramount is going to acquire Warner Brothers now. Netflix basically said, we liked the idea of owning Warner Brothers, but we didn't need to do it as a company. And Paramount seems to be much more desperate to actually acquire these assets. They're buying the entire company instead of just the film and TV component that Netflix was bidding for. So yeah, we are about to enter a new era of Hollywood, and it's not one that I'm looking forward to because, as many people have pointed out, this is going to result in catastrophic layoffs at these companies. There are going to be a bunch of people, thousands of people, who are going to lose their jobs because of this. These two companies merging does not need to happen except to enrich a bunch of already rich executives and shareholders and stuff like that. I suppose on a spreadsheet somewhere, this deal looks good, but in actuality and in real world terms, what this is going to mean is going to be horrific for the city of Los Angeles, the entertainment industry as a whole, and the impacts of this might go even further than that because, as we've mentioned on the show before, the Ellison family who owns Paramount is basically buddying up to the Trump administration, and they've already done some pretty questionable things, let's put it that way, in terms of canceling Stephen Colbert, greenlighting Rush Hour 4. I mean, the list goes on. You can look into the history of that stuff in your own time if you're interested in looking at those connections. But this is not good. It's not good news, and it wouldn't have been good news if Netflix ended up buying Warner Brothers. But in my view, it would have been potentially a better option. But we'll see, I guess. We'll see how serious David Ellison, the 40-something-year-old mogul in the making, is about these claims that he's making. He's talking about making 30 movies a year, 15 films from Paramount, 15 films from Warner Brothers, and releasing all of those in theaters. That seems unlikely to me, but I don't know. I hesitate to say I'll give them a fair shake because what's already happening with consolidation and the idea, especially that the Ellison family, who has leaned pretty far right politically, already has control of CBS News. And now this Warner Brothers deal means that they will control CNN as well. And I believe there was some reporting that said that the Ellisons have gone on record with Trump telling him that they're going to make changes at CNN that he will be very happy with. Again, not good stuff here, folks. But what are we going to do? We just report on the news and hope for the best, I guess. I mean, in terms of what a best case scenario might look like from this, is that this deal actually doesn't go through at all. And people like Senator Elizabeth Warren have been making some noise about this. I think his name is Rob Bonta. He's the Attorney General of California, has said that basically they're going to try to do whatever they can to stop this. They still need to clear some regulatory hurdles, and the deal is not fully done yet. I believe it's going to take still probably like a year or something for it to finally close, but I'm not sure if there's anything that like you and I can do about this. I saw an interview where Elizabeth Warren said what you and I, regular people, can do about this is just talk about it as much as possible and put up a stink about it, so the politicians in office potentially hear that grumbling and realize that this is not something that we want, and maybe they'll actually do something about it. I'm not sure how reasonable that is or realistic that is, but that's where we are right now. Netflix walked away from this whole situation with $2.8 billion as like a breakup fee that Paramount had to pay for them. So good for Netflix, I guess. And I think some trade organizations and movie theaters are trying to band together to potentially try to stop this further consolidation from happening. Again, I'm not entirely certain how successful they'll be, but at least it sounds like somebody somewhere is maybe trying to do something about this. In the event this does go through, which in my view seems depressingly likely, it seems as if Paramount is going to give HBO some independence. That's what they're claiming anyway. David Ellison has essentially said that he wants to leave HBO alone and keep it as the entity that it has been, the sort of premium brand that it has been, and doesn't want to go in there and make a bunch of changes. But once again, we're very much in a wait and see mode. This is the period where somebody like Ellison will basically say whatever they need to in order to get this deal across the finish line and all of the contracts signed and everything fully finalized. And we've seen this happen with other media mergers in the past where they just do not result in the rosy predictions that the people at the top of those companies make at this stage in the process. So historically, this kind of consolidation has been pretty disastrous. And I don't see any reason to think why this is going to be some grand success. And we've talked many times before on the show about the reasons why consolidation in terms of movie studios like this is just a devastating option. And unfortunately, it seems to be happening more and more these days. So that is by far the biggest story in the industry over this past week. We know that Paramount Plus and HBO Max, the streaming services of these two companies, are supposed to be merging into one super service if this deal actually goes through. David Ellison's father, Larry, is one of the richest men in the world. He is the guy behind the tech company Oracle, and they are very into AI and a bunch of technology that David Ellison says, oh, we're going to be able to use all of this fancy technology to enhance the experience for everybody and make this streaming service a great thing. Who knows whether that will actually happen? But a couple of other stories that are tangentially related to this. There's apparently a Game of Thrones movie in the works from writer Bo Willimon, who worked on House of Cards, and he wrote the One Way Out episode of Andor. And he is supposed to be writing this film set in the Game of Thrones universe. It's going to be about Aegon's conquest, which is an event that we've never seen play out on screen, but really sets the stage for everything that we've seen in the entire Game of Thrones universe so far. This is when the Targaryens basically ride in on their massive dragons and take over the Seven Kingdoms, effectively. So it makes sense that Warner Brothers would want to turn this into a movie. David Zaslav, the current CEO of the company, has mentioned several times that he basically wants to extract as much value out of every IP, every major IP that that company has as possible. Freaking David Zaslav, we don't have time to get into him, but he's going to walk away with like hundreds of millions of dollars after this whole thing, after like a notorious legendary streak of mismanagement of this company. But Zaslav especially wants to squeeze as much juice out of these franchises as he possibly can. And then so I'm saying that in case for some reason the Paramount Warner Brothers deal does not go through, it still seems likely that this Game of Thrones movie would be made under a Zaslav owned Warner Brothers company. But even if this does go through, David Ellison recently mentioned that Game of Thrones is his favorite show. So it seems like he might have a personal interest in seeing a story like this get across the finish line as well. So it definitely seems like this could happen. The most interesting thing about this, though, is that HBO is already developing this same exact story about the Targaryens coming to Westeros for the first time and taking over as a TV series with Mattson Tomlin, who is one of the screenwriters of The Batman, working on this show. I think that news came out in 2024. So he's been working on this for a while. So it seems like there are dueling versions of this Aegon's Conquest story in development right now. And we don't know which one is going to win, but it certainly seems like we're going to see that story play out in some form on either the big or small screen. So stay tuned for that. And then speaking of Paramount and speaking of dueling projects, there's another one happening for a new G.I. Joe movie right now. And this is a property that I believe Paramount has a deal with Hasbro, and they have like the distribution rights to make new G.I. Joe movies. And so on one hand, Paramount has hired Danny McBride to write a G.I. Joe movie screenplay, which, okay, sure, fine. Okay, that sounds all right. But then on the other hand, Paramount has also hired Max Landis to write a version. And the idea is that maybe those two scripts could be potentially blended together somewhere down the line. Studios have done this before in terms of like setting up kind of a bake-off situation. I remember this happening with the first Wonder Woman movie several years ago. There was talk about this happening with the Tarzan film. There have been like a bunch of writers' rooms set up for like the Transformers franchise and stuff like that at Paramount. But this is like a direct bake-off, it seems like, where these two projects are being developed in parallel and then could potentially merge into one thing right before production begins or something. The downside, of course, here is that Max Landis, if you don't recognize that name, it's probably a good thing, but he was like a pretty prolific screenwriter in the mid-2010s or so, and then his career ground to a halt after 8 women accused him of emotional and sexual abuse back in 2019. And so this continues a pattern that the new Paramount has of hiring people who have been embroiled in sexual misconduct or had various allegations levied against them. This includes John Lasseter, who has worked with David Ellison at Skydance Animation for several years after he was booted from Disney for really inappropriate stuff there. And then also, of course, the Brett Ratner of it all. I mentioned Rush Hour 4 earlier, and Ratner himself was hit with several allegations years ago and has been persona non grata in Hollywood until he directed a Melania documentary for Amazon, which they overpaid massively for, and there's a whole thing about that. So anyway, not great that Max Landis is getting work right now, considering everything about what I just said, but there we are. And this seems to be a pattern that David Ellison's new Paramount is falling into, and with them scooping up Warner Brothers potentially, I'm not thrilled about what the state of this industry is going to look like and who is going to be potentially brought back into the fold. I mean, are we going to see a string of canceled people get major opportunities under this new studio? Who knows? Anyway, we'll keep you posted as more information rolls in about this. I think it's like an $111 billion deal, which I believe is one of the biggest corporate deals in the history of this country. So that's where we are on Wednesday, March 4th. And I will continue to try to relay as much information as I can to you all so we can kind of track all of this stuff in as close to real time as this podcast format allows. So with that, let's jump into our movie conversations. I'm joined now by Slash Film editor Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
All right, Brad, I did not get a chance to see Scream 7. We're recording this on Friday, but you had a chance to see it, and I'm curious what you made of it, and especially in comparison with the last few Scream movies.
So I went to the Thursday quote-unquote fan event screening last night, packed house. People were definitely excited. They were snatching up Ghostface popcorn buckets and cups and this little like posable like plush doll of Ghostface, because everyone loves a murdering plush. I was curious to see how it was going to turn out, because I thought the premise seemed interesting, and it felt like, yeah, you know, they could do something cool by bringing Sydney back. But it's so clear that despite having Kevin Williamson, the creator and writer of the Scream franchise, in the director's seat that they just really had a hard time figuring out how to shift gears back to Sydney after she was gone in Scream 6 and reconcile the fact that they lost both Melissa Barrera and Jenna Ortega after their departure from the franchise after Scream 6. And the bridge that they make to bring characters from those movies into, you know, Sydney's world, it just all feels kind of contrived. And that's before we even get to the fact that the entire premise of this ghost face is really just super messy and almost feels like something that like a fan would have thought up. And there's an interesting idea here that they could have used to do something cool, but it doesn't feel like it reaches the level of what you want from a Scream movie. It lacks the bite and the sharpness that you want from a Scream script. You know, there's usually really clever horror pop culture commentary and like really fun, you know, meta jokes, stuff like that. And they try, and there's some stuff that lands. There's a few standout moments. There's some really creative kills here, but it just feels like it lacks momentum and urgency. And the ending, the reveal of this movie's Ghostface is thoroughly perplexing and supremely disappointing. Probably the worst of the entire franchise. It's just, yeah, it doesn't make much sense. It lacks impact. And yeah, it just does not feel worthy of this franchise at all.
Okay, so on a story level, it sounds like this is a pretty big creative whiff. But just in terms of like the visceral thrills that you get from watching the standard slasher film fare, does it deliver on that front?
Not really. You know, like I said, a couple of the kills are inventive, and that's cool. But otherwise, it feels like it's on autopilot. There's one moment that I wasn't expecting where I was like, oh, damn. But otherwise, there's nothing that feels thrilling or scary or shocking other than the basic premise of what's happening to Sydney this time. And I'm not entirely aware of how much they've given away in marketing, but the reveal of what they initially think is happening with Ghostface is a little shocking, I guess you could say, you know, if you're like a longtime fan. But what,
Brad, it sounds like you're trying to dance around not giving anything away here in this conversation.
I sure am.
So let's just go ahead and say spoilers for Scream 7 are fully on the table from this point. Because I saw something, again, we're recording this Friday morning, and I saw that like the Thursday night totals from the box office were like a franchise record or something. Like a lot of people are going to see this movie. So I imagine a lot of our listeners have already seen this. And if you are one of the people who haven't and are still interested in seeing it, just fast forward ahead a few minutes. I'm going to try to put some time codes in the show notes that are like approximately accurate depending on the length of ads and stuff like that. So anyway, Brad, you don't have to dance anymore. Just tell me exactly what you're talking about.
All right. So right from the get, basically, once Ghostface starts terrorizing Sydney, the whole thing is like, he's like, oh, I'm not hiding anymore. And he FaceTimes Sydney, and it's Matthew Lillard as Stu Mocker. His face is all scarred from the TV that fell on him and everything. And
that character is fully dead, right?
So that's the big debate throughout the entire movie is, wait a minute, is there any chance Stu could be alive? And there's a whole mystery about it where they have to like go investigate and see, you know, is his body still, you know, is it buried? Do they have the paperwork for it or anything like that? And so the whole thing is trying to figure out whether or not Stu actually is dead or if he's the one really doing this. And like, there's, you know, they're saying that like it's that, talking about deepfakes and how that's possible. And so they don't fully believe it, but then there are things and threads that are revealed that make them start to think that maybe actually Stu is around. And so it's an interesting concept. And if it was executed in a better movie, I think I would have enjoyed it more. I might have even enjoyed it if they actually just did take the big swing and bring Stu back somehow. That might have been more fun. But maybe the best part of it is that you do get to see Matthew Lillard having fun as Stu again in the role. So that's cool. But it's overall, the movie leans too hard into nostalgia for the original trilogy. And there are some like offhanded references, almost jabs at Scream 6 in a way. And it's just like Gale Weathers feels shoehorned into this story. And like I said, the worst part of this is the reveal of the killers, who have no real significance to the history of Scream whatsoever and feel like a real like hard left turn into like, what? Why? Who cares? And like the story itself, as far as how they get set up and everything too, like it feels like there's a lot of, you know, generous liberties taken with like, okay, but like, what if that character didn't learn that or wasn't there? You know, that wouldn't make sense. So I don't know if you want me to come out and say who the killers are, but
well, I guess we can keep that part secret okay. For now. What you're describing reminds me of a term that I learned from Joanna Robinson, who's like a really prolific, fantastic podcaster. I think she podcasts at The Ringer now. But there's this term in storytelling in writers' rooms called arcing out, where a character basically completes their arc and there's not much more you can do with that person. And they're just kind of like sitting around, basically. And it strikes me that Neve Campbell's character in the Scream franchise seems to have arced out at this point. Like, how many times can Sydney go through this same type of scenario over and over again? It's almost like a Die Hard situation where like, really, the same thing is happening to the same guy like six times in a row or whatever. So like, it seemed like the previous movies that introduced that new cast of characters, that was like a perfect on-ramp for a way for them to continue this franchise and like slowly phase out the familiar people. But because of all the behind the scenes drama that went into the making of this movie, that's no longer possible. So they just brought the old cast back again. And it's just kind of like, it seems like it's diminishing returns. I mean, does that feel accurate to you?
Yeah, 100%. Because like, they already did everything you would want to do with bringing Sydney back in Scream 4. So like, it really feels like they're reaching deeper for stuff to like, get on her nerves, you know, but cause like she's named her daughter Tatum in this movie, and obviously Ghostface starts coming after her teenage daughter now, you know, and like the wrinkle of like, oh, is somebody else from the original Scream back, and are they the killer this time, you know, and there are several other deepfake cameos that come into play in the final act as well, and it just feels like it's it almost feels like Ghostbusters Afterlife of the Scream franchise in a way. And it even has McKenna Grace. So there you go. speaking of which, that was one of the other bigger problems that I had with the movie. And I don't know if this is because Kevin Williamson is maybe too old to really be able to tap into the teenage zeitgeist these days. But it doesn't feel like any of the characters around Tatum have any like memorable personalities. Like, they're not characters that you like or like will stay with you. And they don't even really get much time to like make an impression or, you know, do anything significant like the characters in the original Scream did. You know, like they try to give you like proxies for people like Billy and Randy and stuff like that. But none of them feel like they're as interesting or engaging as those characters were.
Well, that's unfortunate. Is there anything else you want to say? I guess without just like outright giving away who ends up being the ghost face or ghost faces in this scenario, but any other aspect that stood out to you?
No, not really. Honestly, it's just a bit of a dud. Just pretty disappointing. And I heard other people leaving the theater talking about how they were disappointed too, that they also thought the killer reveal was weak and that they just were really bummed when it was over.
Well, I guess the question is, even if this ends up making the most money of any Scream franchise entry, do you think the word of mouth is going to be so bad that when they inevitably make a Scream 8, that it's not going to open as much and that trajectory will not continue because people will be a little bit burned by this movie?
I don't know, maybe, because like it seemed like some people weren't really happy with Scream 6, and obviously, you know, the turnout for Scream 7 is still pretty huge. I think Scream fans are the kind of fans that are going to turn out no matter what, really. Like, this is a franchise that has obviously stood the test of time, and like, I mean, the fact that people were buying merch for the movie yesterday and they hadn't even seen the movie yet, like, just tells you everything you need to know about how dedicated, you know, these fans are. So I think that as long as there's a Scream movie, they'll go see it.
Yeah. Well, I guess the takeaway is that we hope that the people making the inevitable next one take the right lessons from the creative failures of this one and can maybe do something to kind of like put some juice back into this franchise. Cause I think, even though everything kind of went wonky with the casting here, maybe there's some other way to give this franchise a shot in the arm, and hopefully people who get paid a lot more than you and I, Brad, can figure out a way to do that. So.
Sure.
All right, Brad, let's talk about Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie. I've been hearing so many great things about this film, and one thing that I want to encourage our listeners to do is to try to see this movie without knowing anything about it, if possible, in advance. Do you think that's probably a wise directive, Brad?
Yeah, 100%. Even to the point that watching the full theatrical trailer probably shows a little too much. Not in the vein of like spoilers necessarily, but it gives a little too much of the main story away. And the way that I was able to experience this was probably perfect and very lucky, because I was not familiar with the TV series beforehand. And I happened to catch the trailer in theaters, and thankfully it was the teaser trailer. So I did not get any hint of the story. It just gave me a vibe that this was a movie kind of like Borat meets The Lonely Island with a little bit of Flight of the Conchords in there. And for me, that was enough. I was like, oh my God, this looks like so much fun. And experiencing the movie that way was so thoroughly rewarding.
Yeah. And we should also say the film comes from Matt Johnson and Jay McCarroll. They're the creators and stars of this. Matt Johnson directed it, and he directed Blackberry from a couple years ago. And I know a lot of our listeners really appreciated that film. So I'm sure people, by the time they're listening to this, know that Matt Johnson is involved in this and that he's the Blackberry guy or whatever. But just for people who haven't been paying close attention to this movie, I wanted to kind of put that aspect into the stew as well as a way to hopefully get people off the fence and actively seeking this film out however they can. So unfortunately, Brad, because of all of that caveat stuff that we just did, I feel like we have to put a spoiler warning up right now, basically, to just talk about this movie in a free way. So I do want to just really, really encourage people to seek this out, because I loved this film. I think it's my favorite movie of 2026 so far. What do you think about it, just like broadly speaking, Brad?
Yeah, this movie is so much fun, and it's like mystifying to watch too, because of the things that they had to pull off and just the delicate dance they're doing in doing this, what it basically amounts to. A parody. So are we into spoilers now then, or?
Well, okay, yeah, let's officially put up the sign right now, spoilers for this movie going forward. So pause or fast forward, go see the movie, and then come back and listen to the rest of this conversation. And Brad had a chance to interview Matt Johnson as well, so we're going to play that at the end of this conversation too. So okay, Brad, we can talk about it freely. What do you want to say?
Yeah, so the fact that this movie is a sneaky remake slash parody of Back to the Future, and one that is so loyal to the story of Back to the Future and even the certain aspects of the filmmaking style, right down to a sound-alike score that sounds almost exactly like Alan Silvestri's score without stealing the direct themes. It's just incredible to watch this, because they also shot it in a guerrilla style where they did a lot of shooting on the real streets of Canada without any of the people around them aware of what they were doing. And there's a little bit of like that, like I said, the Borat Jackass kind of feel to it, where there's like interactions that, you know, could go any number of ways. And there's real people reacting to the things that are happening while they're also pulling off this story that is a blockbuster level high concept story, where Matt and Jay accidentally travel back in time and create all these time paradoxes and mess up their potential future and plans to be this big band. And yeah, it's just, it's so much fun.
I can't believe they pulled this thing off, man. And the thing is, like, when you say all of that, or if I were to read what the plot of this movie is, I don't think I would be fully on board, because Back to the Future is such a sacred text.
Yeah.
And the guys who made Back to the Future, Bob Zemeckis and Bob Gale, have said, like, there's never going to be a remake of that movie as long as we're alive. There's never going to be a sequel as long as we're alive. They have held that property really, really close to the chest. And I'm thankful that they've done that, because it's kept that trilogy really special. And this movie comes along and it's kind of the best case scenario for what a Back to the Future adjacent project looks like, because it actually has the same level of heart that Back to the Future has, which is, I think, an aspect of any kind of storytelling that often falls by the wayside. But this movie is so good at making you really, really care about these characters and the journey that they're on together and their relationship together, that I was not annoyed or bothered in any way by the Back to the Future stuff, even though that movie is so, so special to me, as it is, I'm sure, to like multiple generations of people at this point. So what did you think about that component of it?
Yeah, you know, I think that's one of the things that makes it so surprising and magical, is that it does something that anybody would be like, whoa, 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 no, what are we doing here? But they managed to make it work. And I actually talked to Matt about this in our interview. I think it's actually beneficial to also not even be aware of the show before you go into the movie, because the movie does such a great job of establishing who Matt and Jay are as characters, and it creates this great coming of age framework for the story to unfold without knowing that the show has also a similar basic premise, which is every episode of the show, as I've learned, is about Matt and Jay trying to get their band, Nirvana the band, into a show at the Rivoli, which is this venue in Toronto. And Matt is always cooking up these crazy schemes to try and get them into the Rivoli, despite the fact that they don't have any real recorded songs or anything like that, and they're always riffing songs and things. And that's what the movie does, but it injects it with this high concept time travel story. And so it mixes what Matt and Jay already did so well, but it does so in a way that makes it accessible to any audience. You don't need to be familiar with it to enjoy the show, because I didn't know any of like their inside bits or things that they did on the show, and I was cracking up and absolutely loved what they did here. So if anything, I think it's a testament to how good Matt and Jay are together that they're able to do something like this without anybody, you know, needing to understand the show at all.
Yeah, it totally works. And I've never seen the show. And actually, I believe the show is streaming on like the Internet Archive. I think I found
it. Unfortunately, it is not. It was very quickly taken down after people noticed that it was there. And it's now not available to stream or watch anywhere. And apparently, I talked to Matt about this in the interview as well. Neon seemingly has the rights to that stuff now. And so they're kind of hoping that someone, when they like grab the streaming rights or whatever to the movie, that they'll also grab the rights to the show so that it'll be able to get back out there in a easily available capacity.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I found that link and bookmarked it and was like, okay, maybe I'll watch this after the movie or something, but I didn't actually like click on it to see that it's since been taken down. So kind of bummed about that, but yeah, hopefully that'll result in some sort of official release sometime soon. One of the things that I was so blown away by, Brad, as I'm sure you were, just seeing the way that they incorporated the 2008 stuff with the modern stuff, and there's footage of them from that time almost interacting with footage from them now, and like it's kind of like, how the hell did they pull this stuff off? And it also, speaking to the heart of the movie, it also adds this really, really poignant element of this friendship having lasted over decades and like all of this time having passed, and that just automatically kind of raises the stakes for any kind of story and makes things more emotional. And like at the very end of this movie, I was actually crying, and I was not expecting that from everything I heard about this movie going into it, which is just like, oh my God, it's incredible, it's so funny, whatever. But I think the time component of it has so much to do with the punch that the movie packs at the end of it. So what do you think about how they were able to kind of interweave this new stuff with this footage that they clearly shot years and years ago?
Yeah, that was incredible. And like while I was watching the movie, I was just amazed because it's like, wait a minute, how did they do this? Because for certain sequences, I was like, did they just get like the best digital de-aging special effects done? Because like there's no possible way that they have this footage that perfectly interacts with stuff that they shot today. Or like, did they shoot stuff back in 2008 thinking, okay, one day we're gonna like be able to make this movie, and so we'll shoot this now just in case. But and again, this is something that I talked to Matt about, because I was so impressed and just like baffled by how well it pieces together, and they just spent the time to like go through everything and edit it in such a way that was so perfect. But yeah, and like having that footage, it does add like a layer of authenticity to it that does make you get even more invested in them as characters. Because yeah, it really does pack a big heart in this movie as well. In addition to being extremely funny, it also has what I guarantee will be one of the funniest moments of the year. And like, I was laughing so hard. I'm sure you know exactly what part I'm talking about.
Actually, which part? There are so many funny moments in this.
So it's the part when Jay grabs the gun in his tour bus and accidentally shoots one of his bandmates.
Yes, incredible. I was like, oh man, I like almost fell out of my seat. I was laughing.
I could not believe it. I was not expecting it in the least.
so good. Oh man. Okay, well, I feel like we really could spend like 45 minutes just being like, remember that part? That was amazing. So is there anything else you want to say about this movie before we jump to your interview with Matt?
No, I just love it. Please seek it out if you can. See it in theaters. It's so much fun to see it with a crowd. I got to see it in one of the a smaller theater in Chicago with a pretty decent size crowd, and they were loving it. And it was just, it's so good to be in a theater and laughing with people and having that experience. So if you can, yeah, I can't recommend seeking it out in theaters enough.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie is the name of the film. And I was talking to my wife about this, and we were both saying like, if there are 10 better movies at the end of 2026, if this does not make our best of the year list, 2026 is going to be like an all-timer year at the movies, you know?
Yeah.
Like, this is so good, and it's only February as we're recording this. So I really hope people have a chance to catch this one. I think it's probably not going to have like a huge box office, you know, a huge place at the box office, but I do think it's almost like an instant cult classic, and the earlier you can get on board that train, the better, I think. So here is Brad's conversation with Matt Johnson, the co-creator of this project, the co-screenwriter, co-star, and the director of this movie.
So to begin with, I wanted to explain how I came to Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie, because I was not previously familiar with the series. I saw the teaser trailer in theaters, and it looked hilarious. So I think it's a testament to how fantastic you and Jay are as a comedic duo that someone like me can come into the movie, enjoy it without having any knowledge of the show before it, and it might even make the movie better because it makes it feel like this standalone coming of middle age movie and the trials and tribulations of long friendships.
It makes it seem spontaneous.
Yeah.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, and I think it is an unfortunate side effect of this movie, which it depends how you look at it. I actually think, obviously, for people who've watched the series and who liked it, that I mean, we made it for them, but because they sort of know how we do things and they understand how we shoot for the most part, it isn't the same kind of what the hell is this?
Yeah.
In some ways, I actually feel like the television series is more daring and a little bit more rough around the edges, definitely, but we were able to take more risks because it wasn't a movie. Whereas here, because we know a lot of people are going to be watching it for the first time, it's why we're parodying Back to the Future and right, not something much more esoteric. The original plan was to do it as a parody of a novel, Confederacy of Dunces, mixed with the movie The Talented Mr. Ripley,
okay,
which are both mainstream enough, but they are like in some ways cult media. And so it was a deliberate decision. Most of the credit goes to Jay for making the movie version as quote unquote mainstream as it could be, simply because we knew the way it was produced and the way we were making it was going to be alienating enough on its own. But that's a huge compliment, Brad, so thank you.
Yeah, it really is very funny. And so I wanted to ask you about that original version of the movie, because as I understand it, I know in an interview you mentioned how the only thing that kind of remained from an early version of the movie was the RV, and then you turned that
Yes.
into a time machine. So what was that original idea like, and then how did you shift into this premise instead?
The inspiration was literally that I was traveling around the world with BlackBerry, going to film festivals, not only in different cities, but in different countries. Like I was going all around Europe and then all around America. And it had been a long time. I mean, I don't really travel ever unless I'm going to film festivals. And I was just sort of reminded of the, I guess, the kind of verve that hearing other people speak in different dialects, or hearing like English through a Scottish accent, or hearing the way people speak in like New Orleans, like all of these things, they just really energized me. And I thought, I think it was my own selfish desire to show these different cultures, which is almost an odd thing to say, but like it was like I was jamming my toys together. I was like, oh, I love all of these different people, and I love Nirvana the band, and so let's try to figure out a way to do that. And it was a total experiment. I mean, even more experimental than the movie wound up being. But after we got back from shooting it, we'd driven all over continental America, and we watched it, and it really did feel like the television show,
Yeah.
which wasn't a failure in as much as it's like we didn't we weren't making something for the format, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And we recognized it instantly, and it was, I think, that day that Jay said, oh, we should do something that is parodying a gigantic movie like Back to the Future, and then everything just kind of rolled from there.
That's crazy, 'cause so you do you have like basically a whole version of that movie that like was shot then?
Oh, we shot the entire film.
Oh
Yeah. I
wow. Are
mean,
you
but I mean, the way you have to understand, the way we shoot is so piecemeal that yes, we
Right.
shot the whole movie knowing that we were then going to keep shooting and shoot more and more and more and more. So
Gotcha. Well, do you think you'll release any of that footage at some point?
we're going to release it in the third season of the show.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. So speaking of that, I wanted to ask, I imagine there's probably going to be a lot of renewed interest in the show, especially for people who weren't familiar with it before, but it's not easily available, at least
It's
not in
not
the.
available anywhere. Yeah.
Yeah,
We're
so.
Neon, I think, is trying to release it with a network. I imagine whoever winds up buying the streaming rights to the movie, we're hoping will also buy the TV series, and
Nice.
then that will become the home for the third season of the show as well. But that's in a perfect world.
Yeah.
That's it's ideally speaking.
I hope that happens, because I definitely would love the opportunity to like dig into the show now, because like this just sold me on wanting to see everything else you guys did before it.
If you like the movie, you will love the show.
Awesome.
It's like a reel you ain't seen nothing yet.
That's great. So I saw in another interview you did that you guys shot for 200 days, which is wild. What was one of the most difficult days you guys had?
They're not things that you would have thought about when you watch the movie, because I think one of the great things that the movie does, and the trick even works on me, is making everything seem so effortless. And like shot to shot, it's all happening in real time. But easily the hardest thing to do in the movie was shooting that sequence where we have the wheelbarrow and the cable is going up to
Yeah.
the second tower. We shot that for days and days and days and days and days.
Wow.
And shooting it in different places. Like we shot it, I feel like we shot that scene for like on and off for a month. And then that simple little shot of me, you remember when I parachute and land on the streetcar and then
Yeah.
jump off and then jump into the street and then run through the intersection?
Yeah.
That also, we basically spent an entire night
Wow.
shooting. And just literally just the single shot where the camera starts in the streetcar, then goes out, you see me jumping off the streetcar and then running. Yeah, that was a horrible night.
What made the cable scenes like, why did you have to shoot for so long for it?
Because it was so technically challenging,
Oh, okay.
way more technically challenging than we had anticipated. Like how to get that cable to look right, how to do it in public with all real people without like getting the attention of the authorities. Like there were so many things going on in that sequence that we did not anticipate until we went out to shoot it the first time, and so we would really only be able to go out and shoot it for like, 5 or 10 minutes at a time before we'd need to like break away and then
Wow.
and then put things back together again. It was very hard.
Yeah, that's awesome. On a related note, I was curious, how did you guys pull off the CN Tower bit for the opening? Like, how much of that was real? And then, like, how did you guys figure out the shift into what I assume is like visual effects for the actual
Right.
parachute jump and everything?
That was also extremely challenging, but in a different way, because obviously we only shot that once, but the logistics to figure out how to even approach that, because it's not like, well, that CN Tower is like a national
Right.
monument in our country, and I will just say that we did not know, we were not in control of anything. And so it was very, very, very difficult
Yeah.
to make that happen in the way that it did. Yeah, and you were very grateful to the CN Tower.
And also, I mean, kudos to your visual effects team too, because they made everything look as seamless as they possibly could, which I imagine was probably more difficult considering how you guys shoot your stuff, and they couldn't make it look like a glossy blockbuster movie. It had to look like it was captured just as rawly as the video was.
That is a testament to Tristan Zarafa, who has been my VFX supervisor since I was literally a kid.
Wow.
Like on my first film, he did the VFX on the Dirties, and him and Kurt Lobb, one of the editors of this, have worked out a methodology where they're aiming to create this illusion that you're talking about, where typically they will kind of go back and forth on how to do exactly what you say, which is hide VFX or use VFX from a storytelling point of view to make it feel like everything that's happening is real, as opposed to what VFX normally do, which is making the which is just manifesting the surreal,
Yeah.
right? It's like you show an imagined creature, like there's a natural, well, this clearly didn't happen, and that's why it's VFX. And their approach is much closer to using VFX to make you think something really did happen.
Right. I wanted to talk about another super impressive, what essentially feels like a magic trick that you guys did, because you used some old footage from when you guys shot the show and everything and incorporated it into the movie. But I wanted to understand how you guys did that with the apartment sequence, because it feels so seamless, and like it made me think that you guys somehow had like the best digital de-aging effects ever because of how well that footage interacts with the new stuff you shot. How did you guys figure that out?
That's just our editors, Kurt Lobb and Bobby Upchurch, who painstakingly went through footage of Jay and I when we were young and wrote that sequence backwards from the shots that they found. So I agree, it's seamless. I watch it and I'm like, how did this happen?
Yeah.
And there's zero VFX except for one shot that Luca Tarantini did of a face replacement. But everything you're watching is just basically the adult Jay and I improvising against the ghosts of
Wow.
ourselves.
That's amazing. That's yeah, it is there's so many cool things like that you guys did in this movie that just made it like mystifying to watch, because it makes it feel like you guys almost knew you were going to make this movie and shot that footage, like, just in case we'll make this, so many years later.
Yeah, right. 20 years ago?
Yeah.
No. It's funny. I think if we had shot this footage planning to turn it into a movie, would have been much worse. I think a disaster, because I think you would have seen the effort,
Yeah.
young selves, and yeah. I mean, who knows? Somebody eventually will do this. They will make a movie where they plan to this stuff that far in advance, but I don't see us doing anything like that.
So I know you worked very closely with a lawyer to make sure everything in here would be covered under fair use by having it be a parody. Was there anything that you had to cut in order to balance that, dance, and that you were bummed to lose?
Yes, the I've talked about this before, but the only real heartbreaking moment in the movie was the opening credits to Back to the Future is this amazing song called "The Power of Love" by
Oh yeah.
Heathens. And originally, I wanted that song to be in the sequence where I build the time machine, and there was nothing we could do to either clear it legitimately
Yeah.
or to fair use it. There was nothing we could do,
Dang.
And look, the Johnny Be Good there is also excellent.
Yeah.
Like it's like the famous song from that movie, but that was, yeah, I mean, but at the same time, it's also a miracle because that was the only single example that we have of something where we couldn't do it and we wanted to do it.
Yeah. Was there anything that you couldn't get clearance for when it came to using all the old ads in 2008?
Well, no, because we fair used all of that.
Oh, okay. But I was just so because I the one thing that was amazing was the stuff you find that you use was like just all the inappropriate things that just haven't aged well, like the Jared,
Right.
Got Milk ad and the Cosby cover. Like that was so great.
And you know what? Strangely, the cultural relevance of those images is what made for a strong fair use case because
Oh.
you're trying to prove to an audience that this is 2008, and
Right.
so those images and signs do that instantly. It's like the film is trying to make a case using those
Right.
images. So without them, the point wouldn't be made.
So we talked about that the musical moment that you had to change, but I wanted to ask about the movie's score because the orchestral cues in this movie, they sound just like Back to the Future, and I was wondering, did you guys use any real Back to the Future music, or just this amazing sound alike?
No, that's just the brilliant work of Jay McCarroll, who not only is the star and the co-writer, but also the composer. And he does the music for all of my films. And
Yeah.
so it's not like this just happened by accident. The whole reason we met is because he wanted to become a film composer when he was a kid. Like that's the origin of our friendship. And so here, really for the first time, he was able to do a full gigantic 80s, like real orchestration of a movie because he loves Silvestri and he like, he grew up on these scores, and so no, there's no Back to the Future music in it at all, except for a tiny little sting that we use really as a punchline. And everything else is just Jay really custom crafting a Back to the Future sounding score to our film. And in fact, the full score just released today on Spotify, and I know Neon is releasing a vinyl
Oh,
of the
awesome.
score, which is amazing. And I've heard it, and it's unbelievable. There's also an amazing behind the scenes feature being released on the Blu-ray of the orchestra that recorded the music. Like
Awesome.
I think it's like a 30 or 40 piece orchestra that Jay used to
Yeah.
compose it. It's amazing.
It was so impressive. Like it sounds exactly like the most famous cues from the Back to the Future score.
Yeah. Well, again, he comes by it honestly. Like he's a true fan.
That's so good. So I wanted to ask, you've done some great like things that have really moved the needle, on the film festival circuit and whatnot. I really liked Operation Avalanche. Blackberry was something that I feel like really jumped, even further, and like there was award season contention, stuff like that. Do you have any like big like Hollywood aspirations? Like do you have anything that would want to make your own Back to the Future, or any franchises that like you would think, oh man, it would be amazing to be able to work in this world?
You know what? I would have said no, but the truth is, my whole life, basically from like when I first graduated high school, I wanted more than anything to make a Magic the Gathering movie
Oh wow.
because that was the game that taught me how to read, and it changed my life like completely. Even though it is just a card game, like it's probably the most important thing that I ever came across. In terms of having an influence on me. And so that more than anything is a project I would, yeah, it's a real died and gone to heaven
Yeah, that's a big one for sure.
project.
I also wanted to ask, I know you're working on the Anthony Bourdain movie, and I was curious, is there anything that like you've learned from your work on any of your previous movies that you've brought into this movie, or and is there anything that's become kind of a fresh challenge that you are, has been difficult to face, but it's one that you're ex also excited about?
Both of those happened, and for me, I was trying to challenge myself with this Bourdain movie to shoot something that finally was not using the aesthetics of a live documentary, like to shoot a movie where the camera never moved, apart from some rare cases. Like it's something that I've always been extremely afraid of, for obvious reasons, because I'm using those aesthetics to as storytelling devices. But I mean, I basically made a deal with myself and my cinematographer that we thought we could do this, mostly because on all my other films, I realized that my favorite thing to do would be put actors I like in a close-up, like as close as they can be. And so 90% of this movie is just like my favorite actors in the world acting in a close-up. And so that I definitely stole from the documentary aesthetics that Jared Rabb and I developed in all of our previous films, which is that like you just as soon as the actor turns on, you just get into a close-up as fast as you can.
That's really cool. As I wrap up here, one thing I wanted to ask, I guess, who are some of the filmmakers that you say you look to the most as far as like inspiration for your filmmaking style, or when you feel like you're stuck in your own head and like you're trying to figure something out? Are there any filmmakers who are like a touchstone, you know, that you try like go and watch their work, or you think about, you know, how they operate?
You know what? I think I'm an outlier in that I actually do not have a strong visual sense, and I don't think about filmmaking in a shot-to-shot way. I think in the way that most filmmakers that you talk to would. I m movies cast a spell on me, and if I like the movie, am unable to. I have no idea what's happening. I read in Werner Herzog's latest autobiography that something very similar happens to him, which is that if a movie is good, he just observes the story and can't unpack it. Like he can't break it into its component pieces, and neither can I. And so it's not like I watch movies that I love and think, okay, I can steal this shot or I can move the camera like the way that they do. The movies that I get most inspired by every single time are always documentaries.
Okay.
And so the example on this movie that you just watched was a documentary shot in Seattle in the 1980s called Streetwise.
Okay.
That was the main inspiration for how we tried to approach the shooting of this movie. And we talked about it all the time. But it's honestly more reading that I get ideas and inspiration from. And I find that if like reading books or reading comic books is where I turn to, as you say, like when I'm feeling like, oh, I need an idea, or I'm feeling like I mean, pick your term, basically when you're looking for inspiration,
Yeah.
I get all of that from literature and comic books, which I consider literature. So it's rare for me to turn to a movie to get filled up in that way. Not to say I don't love movies,
No, for
like
sure.
I love them, but I am in some ways too ignorant to use them as a technical motivation.
Gotcha. Right on. Well, that's the time I got. So it was great talking to you, man. I love this movie so much, and I hope that the show becomes easily available to watch here in the States sometime soon, because I can't wait to check more of it out.
Well, when you do, we'll come talk again.
That would be amazing.
It was nice meeting you, Brett.
Thanks a lot, Matt.
With me now is Slash Film editor BJ Colangelo.
Hi, hi, hiya.
All right, BJ, we're here to talk about Pillion, the new movie from director Harry Lytton that stars Alexander Skarsgård and Harry Melling. And I imagine, well, I don't imagine, I have had some insight into your reaction to this movie. I've seen you speaking very fondly of it internally in our Slash Film Slack. So let me just ask you to explain to folks why you like this movie and what your read on it is.
Oh my God, yes. I love this movie so much. And the reason that I love this movie so much is because I have a great affinity for one, I'm always rooting for any story that's a little gay. That I think is a given. But the fact that this is a story about a gay relationship that is also dealing with counterculture, sex communities, and is really messy and very complicated, because I think, especially right now, given the fact that the LGBTQIA plus community is facing so much adversity and oppression just across the globe, there's this knee-jerk reaction that we want to tell stories that are like very palatable and very sanitized and very good you know, trademark symbol good, in order to, you know, not give our oppressors any ammunition to hurt us. And so because of that, a lot of our experiences, a lot of our stories are just getting really flattened and it's getting really sanitized and boring. And this movie is the complete opposite of that. This movie is really daring in a lot of ways and is also taking a topic that is really salacious, but making it very sweet and very gentle in a lot of ways. And I think it's walking a really wild tonal line here that ran the risk of falling off the rails and never did for me. I absolutely adored this movie.
I liked this movie quite a bit. I thought it was like a very, very nice movie. I had the issue, one of the issues that I had with it was I thought Harry Melling did a great, great job as the, I mean, it's his movie. He's the lead character. He plays.
Oh, absolutely.
Colin. And I just felt like he's 35 years old or something like that. And I just felt like I wish maybe both characters could have been aged down a little bit because of some of Colin's, like the way he lives with his parents and the way that his parents, like, they come to the door first and kind of greet Ray, Alexander Skarsgård's character. And they like are like making sure that Colin is wearing a helmet, you know, when he's on the motorcycle and stuff like that. Like some of the family dynamics and like the personal decisions that Colin makes as a character, it felt like a coming of age story. And I just felt like maybe Harry Melling was like a bit too old to be coming to these realizations about himself. But that was my sort of a arm's length reading on it. So, and I know that this is based on a book that came out in 2020. And I believe the character, the Colin character, is only like 18 or something in that book. So that idea made a lot more sense to me. But did that bother you at all? Or did you think about the age component of it at all?
So when it comes to queer stories, a thing I think people need to recognize if they're not familiar with it is queer time theory. So queer time theory is this idea that queer people, given the fact that a lot of us are not able to hit our coming of age milestones in a linear fashion because we either learn things about ourselves later in life or we do know things about ourselves, but we're not able to actually engage in them the same way that straight and cisgender peers are able to do so. A lot of queer people's timelines are different. They're stunted. It's why you can have a story, like I've talked about this movie on the show before, but it's called like The Down Low, where Lucas Gage plays a character who's like in his early 20s and Zachary Quinto's character is in his like late 40s. But Zachary Quinto was married to a woman because he was closeted his whole life. So it's like, even though he's older and definitely has like, you know, more experience in terms of like queerness, he does not have the same experience as the 20-year-old who came out when he was 16. So like
it, right.
A lot of queer people's coming of age timelines are very stunted. And so for Colin's, the character of Colin played by Harry Melling, it like did, like it made total sense to me. And not to mention like he's also the most subby of submissive bottom boys, but he hasn't figured out what that means for him yet. He's not explored that part of him. And so we've seen those sort of people-pleasing behaviors exhibiting in his life outside of like a bedroom capacity. He does live at home. He's taking care of his mother who is ill. He's going on dates, being set up by his parents. Like that is very much people-pleasing submission. And it's only when he actually gets to experience it within this like dom sub relationship that like a lot of things go aha and click for him. You know, had this been something he was able to discover about himself earlier in life? Yeah, probably. So even though the book is much younger, seeing somebody in his 30s have this experience, I'm like, no, this makes total sense to me. I know a lot of queer people who have figured something out about themselves in their 30s. Even like I know trans women who've transitioned in their 50s. Like, so it doesn't faze me at all. This is normal to me.
Yeah. Okay. That tracks. I have to admit, like, I was engaged in like a push and pull in this movie where I was like, I'm very, you know, as I mentioned, it's basically a coming of age story. And I was glad to see the Colin character go on the arc that he went on. And without spoiling anything too much, come to a better sense of himself and like draw some boundaries and kind of establish like, this is what I want and need out of a relationship, even in that kind of a submissive world. So I spent half the movie going like, this is really nice for this guy. And then the other half being like, absolutely couldn't be me. Like just something about the personality of like what it takes to be engaged in that kind of relationship. Either way, honestly, from the Alexander Skarsgård's character's perspective and from the Harry Melling's character's perspective, just kind of like this is a window into a world that is so far from any kind of behavior that I would ever engage in, just like not even sexually, but just there's something about like the way that that certain people are wired to be interested in engaging in that relationship. And I just don't have that wiring. So this was like a really fascinating, yeah, like I said, window into a culture. It was almost like watching a documentary or something about a world that you've never known before. And I'm sure you had a totally different experience with it because you mentioned you know people who have transitioned late in life. I'm sure, do you have people in your life who are in relationships like this, or have you ever met people who are actually in relationships like this? Okay.
Absolutely. And like, you know, I'm not about to like air out my own dirty laundry on, you know, the Slash Film Weekly podcast, but before my wife and I got married, like, yeah, I was absolutely immersed in the leather community. And the only reason that we're not now is because we're a boring old married couple now. But you know, this, like so many of the people in this movie, like that feels like family and feels like community to me. There are so many people that I know that are still actively in these sorts of relationships, in these sorts of dynamics. And the thing that I really respected about this movie is that this isn't meant to be a like intro to DS Leather 101. Like that's just not what it's trying to do. It's like, this is very much about a specific relationship, and you get like little glimpses of the overall community, which I really like, because I do think there, when we have movies like this, or when we have any sort of story that deals with counterculture sex communities, I feel like a lot of filmmakers get it in their head of like, well, I need to represent the absolute best version of this because I don't want to like, you know, stigmatize or like make people think this is how it always is, knowing how many people are totally unfamiliar with this sort of world. But this movie resisted that. And I was like, God, I love that. Thank you for not turning this into like a very special episode about BDSM.
Right. Yeah. There are so many other characters that these guys are kind of like, they're in this biker community, and you can see all these other relationships on the fringes and kind of like in the corners of certain frames, or like they'll go out to, you know, a lake or something like that. And you'll see like all these other relationships that are never really explored or commented on, because that's not what this movie is interested in. But by including all of those people, it does not become this sort of like polemic, here's what this relationship or, you know, this kind of dynamic means, you know, for the world at large or whatever. It's just like, these are two guys who happen to be you know, a part of this community in the UK or whatever. So I thought it was a really, really nice touch. Like, you don't really get to know any of those other supporting characters. Like, I could not tell you any of those characters' names, but their presence means a lot for the film, I think.
Yeah. And something that people might not know is that many of those characters, they are just people from that community. They just cast people who are active in the community to make sure that like the representation was accurate. And I flagged it pretty quickly when I saw a lot of their tattoos. I'm like, that's not a fake tattoo. That's your real tattoo. Oh, these are just leather boys. Okay, got it. I love this. And I do think that it adds something to it to see those relationships and see those dynamics in the background, because again, it is so much about Colin learning about himself, learning where his boundaries are. And I like that this is a movie about learning where your boundaries are by doing, by exploring, by testing those fences, because I think so many people resist exploring things about themselves because they're afraid that they're not going to like something, or in all honesty, they're afraid that they're going to like something. And that fear is what keeps them from, you know, going on that adventure and trying something and figuring it out. Because ultimately, with a lot of stuff, like, yeah, you're not going to know if it's for you until you do it. And it might unlock some things in you that maybe you're not ready to unlock, or it might unlock something that's going to like completely, you know, make you understand like, oh, this is exactly what I am into. This is the thing that makes me happiest. This is the thing that brings, you know, the most amount of pleasure in my life. And when you are able to explore that comfortably with, you know, a partner or partners in a way that feels validating and feels right for you, it does have positive influences on the other aspects in your life, because you're not worried about like keeping this thing harbored or, you know, struggling with those emotions. And we see that throughout this movie, which I really love.
Yeah, that's absolutely the part that I really connected to or really appreciated, like being able to watch Colin kind of come to those realizations himself. Let's talk for just a second before we wrap it up about Skarsgård, because his character, like, I initially was like, man, this guy's kind of an asshole. And then you see these little flickers throughout the movie where he will be engaged in some sort of activity with Colin, and you'll see that he is actually paying a little bit more attention to Colin's experience than you might think. And he does not necessarily show his emotions in a traditional way, but there are little moments along the way where he kind of like, the movie kind of lets us into just a glimmer of what he's thinking, and like that there is a tiny bit of a sensitivity that that he has to the Colin character. And it's not just this purely like, I'm going to dominate you in every single way, every single minute of every hour kind of thing. So what did you think about his performance and that character, the Ray character in this?
Oh, I love this character so much because, you know, the initial reaction I think a lot of people are going to have is like, God, this guy sucks, because he is, you know, a little standoffish. He is a little cold. But it's exactly what you're saying. Like, there are these little moments where you do kind of see where he really is and where the line between the performative role and like who he is, like where those lines are, where they blur, where they converge. I think that he is doing such a magnificent job in this because he's Alexander Skarsgård. So like, he doesn't really have to try. He could just stand there and be hot and you're like, yeah, I'll do whatever you say, man. Cool. And so like, you have that aspect of it, but it's when you do have those smaller moments where you do recognize the way that he's being mindful, because ultimately, like, in these relationships, people always think that like, oh, the dom is the one in charge. No, they're not. The bottom is the one who's in charge. The submissive is the one who, you know, controls the balance, because ultimately, like, it's their boundary that you are, you know, having to maintain and be mindful of the entire time. And so we see that sort of happen, especially I'm so obsessed with when they go on like their little camping trip with like the whole group. I think it's like one of the most beautiful things that I've seen in a very long time. And like that one, for sure, it's like you start to really see the little ways that he cares about Colin and he's being mindful and giving, you know, what he wants and, you know, maybe is, you know, unafraid to express, because that's also, you know, part of his job and part of his role is to be able to recognize that. I think this movie is very, very sweet amid, you know, the subject matter. I think that it's incredibly sweet, but Skarsgård is like so perfect. And honestly, I can't really imagine them casting anybody else in these roles. I think it's just perfect. I think they are so perfect together.
Yeah. It's really interesting that Colin is the younger character by at least a decade, I think, but he has more emotional maturity than the Ray character. And like, he looks up to Ray as much as I think he's turned on by him and is like, you know, interested in him. But without really getting into exactly what happens, I think the movie reveals that Ray is like not on the same level as Colin in certain parts of his life, you know? And I just thought it was like a really interesting choice, and it gives Skarsgård a little bit more to do than just be the kind of like glowering hot guy who's standing in the corner and, you know, telling somebody to lick his boots or whatever. So
totally, like, there's, without spoiling anything, you'll know it when you see it, but there is a look that Skarsgård gives towards the end of this movie that like is haunting. It's so beautiful and so emotionally charged, and he doesn't say a damn word and you can just read like a novel on his face. It's amazing.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go now to your interview. You had a chance to talk to Harry Lighton, and he's the director of this movie and the writer as well. And then Harry Melling, the actor who plays Colin, they were together. And here is that conversation now.
So my first question for you is that Colin is on such a path of self-discovery, and it's happening through an avenue that so many people, I think, are terrified to explore, not just because they're afraid that they won't like it, but they're terrified that they will like it. And so I'd love to know from each of you, was there ever a time in your life when you faced a situation or an opportunity for self-discovery that was gained by allowing yourself to just go for it?
Yeah. To be honest, like every single acting job to a certain degree, do you know what I mean? You're sort of like you do your homework, you go, oh, here we go. I hope I can, I hope I can be of service to this brilliant bit of writing or this very intriguing, complex character. And you're like, what have I done? I'm the wrong person. I'm not going to be able to do it. And then obviously there comes a point when you're in your trailer before jumping on to the set where you're like, okay, this is the moment. It's sink or swim, and you sort of jump. So, yeah, I could very much relate to, I guess, Colin's courageousness that he the journey that he goes on in the film. That was a yeah, I could connect to that for sure.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I was just thinking, like, I think both like starting out making films and then also starting out exploring being gay, I think they sort of fall in a similar place in a way for me, and that it was like they both were intimidating but offered the opportunity for self-discovery, and like and the intimidating thing was also the rewarding thing in a way, was that I felt like I'd have to make a commitment to both of them in order to gain what I wanted from either, and yeah, and it's sort of ongoing, I guess, is always intimidating, but the reward feels worth it.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm a lesbian and my wife is trans. And when we first started dating, I was like, oh, great. I'm about to blow up my entire life to be with this person. And every day is a new adventure. And yet it's still the best decision I've ever made. So this movie resonates
Reach.
with me on like a molecular level. So this question is a bit awkward since you're both in the room, but I think the casting of Alexander Skarsgård for Ray makes complete sense because he's Alexander Skarsgård, but I cannot imagine anyone else playing Colin. Harry, I think you are just so fantastic in this role. And so, for the director, I am wondering what was it about him that made you go, it has to be him. This is my Colin.
It was, well, it's funny you say that. Like, it was a similar thing in that I mean, I didn't write with Harry in mind, but as soon as I started the casting process, he was the only person I could think of. I remember, you always sort of draw up a list, right? A short list, and Harry was at the top of the list, and then the other Pete, I couldn't think of anyone else really to put on the list who I thought would be a viable backup. And I think it's because Harry's had like proven through different roles he'd done that he was able to be like incredibly magnetic and captivating to an audience, but in a way which was the antithesis of what I wanted from Ray, and it was what I wanted from Colin. He could be magnetic in a way which wasn't macho or sort of alpha, and that's like a very rare quality on screen, I think.
Oh, absolutely. It's all in your eyes. Like the way that I love the watching actors look at other people and the way that you look at Ray, it just like full body tingles. It's so beautiful and wonderful. You did such a wonderful job.
He's a lovely man to look at, so
Also true. And I don't even like men. And yet it's like, maybe. Have I been wrong? So for you both, counterculture sex communities are so stigmatized that I do think that there is a responsibility for those involved with telling these stories to not further that stigmatization while also still being truthful to the story that these characters are having at the center. What do you think for the both of you was the biggest challenge in ensuring that you are doing right by the real people who do live this way while also keeping Ray and Colin's story honest?
I think the biggest challenge for me was just doing was I mean it's sort of what you've just described. It was making sure that this story stayed the story of one dom sub relationship that was like complicated and didn't serve as like the blueprint for a community, while simultaneously showing that it wasn't the blueprint for a community. So I guess the way I ultimately sort of sought to address that was by representing a variety of dom sub relationships within the community whilst still centering Ray and Collins. And that's where like building the bike gang around them emerge from, and you know, doing that with people from the gay biking community and the kink community. So making sure that we had their input in telling their stories, whilst also allowing Colin Reyes to remain specific and individual, and not like a kind of public service announcement.
Yeah, I think the fact that they, members of the GBMCC, which is the Gay Bikers Motorcycle Club, alongside some people that were in the kink scene locally to London, the fact that they were involved in the movie, I think, was so important. I think, from an acting viewpoint, it was just super useful and helpful. If there was a question about how would one lean over this trestle table before an orgy scene? They would be on hand to help us sort of make sure that what we were presenting was true and was correct. So I'm so grateful that they were brave enough to get involved and to trust us, I guess, with this story. And I'm thrilled. It seems that they seem thrilled with it as well, because it's very scary to act on screen, especially if you haven't done it before. It's a very intimidating, thing to do, and they did it and then some. And to see them sort of seemingly feel proud of the story that we told and the fact that this now exists in the world for people to see, I think it was a lovely moment to sort of be a part of.
Yeah, that's definitely what drew my attention to the project when I started seeing images and trailers where you would see these big groups, and I could tell as a viewer, like, that those are real people. Those are not actors. That's community. This is wonderful. And so this unquestionably is also the sweetest movie to feature somebody being put in a surfboard stretch. And I felt myself getting kicky feet in the theater with joy, watching just such an intimate physical exploration of two characters learning so much about each other. And so for each of you, was there ever a moment during production where you're filming a scene, director calls cut, and you can still feel that joy hanging in the air?
Yeah, all the time with this, like, I mean, I was yelling cut, so I guess it's different for me. But I like when we were filming the scenes in the water, where they all like run into the water after the bike trip. That was like, it was doing something like that, where while it's meant to look joyful, for the water was also freezing. It created like a camaraderie, and so after the take, some of them would be like charging out and running for their dressing gowns, and then the others would be like taking the piss out of them as they like hankered down. One of the couples, what I remember, went and just like the film couples, I mean, they weren't a couple in real life, but they went and just like sat on a rock in the water and had like kind of cuddled each other in between takes. It was very present throughout that day, but also kind of throughout the shoot. Whenever we were filming with the bike gang, it was very loud in the mix, that feeling of joy.
I was charging out, of course,
Yeah.
trying to find my dressing gown as quickly as possible because it was so cold. No, but that was a really fun day. Often when you're in like situations where you can't deny the reality of it, i.e. going into a freezing lake or wrestling, you can't deny the fact that you're tussling and you're on top of each other, and often those days are super fun, and you do feel incredibly energized by it, as well as surprised. I mean, there was countless moments where you start a scene and you end the scene and it's gone in a somewhat different direction, or it's got a slightly different flavor to it. And again, those moments are really energizing because it sort of, it pushes you on to the next and you start building, and it's just, yeah, it was a really lovely shoot.
Yeah, I love hearing that. And so I have an acting question for you. Over the years, I've talked to plenty of actors who've been in horror movies who have talked about how sometimes, you know that you're acting, but your body doesn't know that you're acting. And then you have to decompress after because your body is reacting as if you really were just fighting for your life against a slasher or a monster or what have you. So after spending so much time acting out as a submissive and kind of being in this, performative subspace, did you ever feel the urge of like, I think I need aftercare after having this day?
No, I think weirdly I felt the opposite. I felt I don't know, I found Colin's bravery quite inspiring in lots of ways. So maybe that sort of lingered for a bit. I remember after shooting, I would do things that often, like this is like way after shooting, I would do things that in my life that I don't think I necessarily would have, done before. I guess there was a curiosity to me that maybe might have crossed over for a while. And that always happens. I mean, like you say, every single role, there's some strange crossover that you can't quite put your finger on, but you just feel it. It's there. And I think actually for this, it was a sense of curiosity and bravery and, why not?
I love that. So something else that I have not been able to stop thinking about since seeing this movie is that collaring is such a sacred act. And when we return to Colin after Ray leaves and we see him without it, I immediately was like, oh, this poor baby boy, what was that situation like to take that collar off? So I would love to know for the both of you the theories about like what is going through Colin's mind when that happens, when the decollaring happens and Ray is not there.
Yeah. Well, I think I suggested that I suggested I was like suggesting to Harry like we should see the decollar, we should see like the collar coming off, we should see it. And it was a really bad idea. It was a really bad idea because dramatically it's very uninteresting in terms of like, because of course it's a big act. It would take some time to get that chain
I
off.
yeah, and it's interestingly, just speaking to someone at Mid-Atlantic Leather, which is this like enormous leather convention. And it was the secretary, and he picked up on the fact that you also don't see the collar being put on in the film. He was like, I love that because collaring is it means something different to everyone who does it or has a collar put on them. And so the fact that you don't see it allows it to exist in the kind of imaginative space of the audience rather than someone being like, oh, well, that isn't familiar to my experience of it. And I think often with those details which do pack a lot of emotional weight to a lot of individuals who will be watching the film, sometimes treating them a bit like the monster in a horror film and letting them exist off screen is richer for the imagination and richer for their ability to empathize with the experience of the character.
Oh, agree completely. When I was watching, Colin's dad driving him around, I had this just building dread. I was like, if I have to see his dad take wire cutters to this, I'm gonna barf in the middle of the screening.
I'm sorry to say that was pretty much my suggestion.
Oh my God. I would have been
Get the cutters.
bawling my eyes out. It would have been, I would have not been okay at all. Like, it would have been powerful, but I would have been not okay,
It would
which
have
I
been
think is.
simultaneously powerful and like comedically clumsy, I imagine, having
Oh,
just
of
been sitting there.
course.
So awkward.
Yeah, I think it's very revealing about myself of that would have just de devastated me. And so the last few years, there have been countless debates about quote unquote necessary sex scenes. And then we have a film like this or a show like Heated Rivalry becoming international phenomenons and, Pillions winning all of these awards. So from your perspectives, what changed?
It's so interesting that because I don't have an answer for it other than that, like maybe because there was a lot of backlash to that discourse around people saying that they were done with sex scenes and that like sex scenes weren't necessary at all. At least in like my circle, there was a lot of people being like, well, this is complete crap. And for me, like the I've always been pretty clear in my mind on what I find to be a quote unquote good or a bad sex scene or a like worthwhile one or a not worthwhile one. And it's got nothing to do with like sex in some kind of categorical aspects and everything to do about what the like sex is doing in service of the storytelling or the characterization. So I mean, a version of Pillion without any sex in it would have been the like egregious error to me, like telling a story about kink and keeping all the sex off screen would have been like me passing judgment on that kind of sex. So this film, if someone writes an article about how the sex in Pillion was unnecessary, then I'd definitely have a something to say about it, I think.
Yeah, it would have been such a betrayal to the story and these characters. Like, it's so necessary to see what we see and how they explore. Harry, for you as an actor, have you noticed a shift at all?
I mean, I haven't seen Heated Rivalry, so and I'm trying to think before then. I mean, not really. I mean, not really. What I will say about the sex scenes is that it's nice that, like Harry has just said, that the scenes housed such story, you know? Like it's not often we see a sex scene go wrong and not work, and like someone be really appalling at the act of, you know, a blowjob. All that stuff is, you don't often see that. And coming to this, that's what I was so excited about in a way. Like, how do you do that with an honesty and authenticity? Because I mean, maybe people got bored of, or like, maybe people questioned the necessity of sex because actually the way that sex was being portrayed sort of became flat, and it wasn't actually addressed in a way which actually was looking at the people having sex and why they were doing it. And the thing that really excited me was that it felt like that's the only thing that this movie was doing, you know, like the sex is so vital. It's so vital in telling Colin's story of inexperience to inexperience. And like we've all said, the sex not being there would, it just would being a really shit film. So yeah, I haven't seen Heated Rivalry, so I can't comment on that, but maybe it's something about the way in which sex is being portrayed on screen changing, and maybe that is what's allowing this sort of, you know, this new phase of people really enjoying that aspect of TV and film.
It's been a very refreshing change. So I have time for one last question. So many filmmakers play it safe for their future directorial debut, and they'll start swinging for the fences on maybe film number two or film number three after they've so-called proven themselves. But you really came out the gate with such a confident and well-assured feature set in a world that is still viewed taboo by the majority. So what was it about this story that you knew this had to be your first feature?
I think I just like I cared about the subject. My short films had explored in some version of kind of countercultural sex, and so I was looking for something in that kind of thematic world. But then I also I guess sort of drawn to like films where the tones don't necessarily sit neatly with the subject matter, and by neatly I mean in terms of like an audience's preconceptions of what they're going in to get when they go see a BDSM romance. And when I read the novel, that was the thing which really struck me. It was, you know, even though I think that the novel is tonally a fair bit different from the film, it had this real sense of like surprise that delighted me in the way it applied kind of comedy and sincerity and shock and tenderness to a subject which I think is often quite two-dimensionally treated. And I also was like, well, you know, maybe I'll never get the chance to make another film in my life, so I might as well swing big, because if I get to do only one film, I should have a crack at the one I want to make.
Amazing. Well, I hope that this is not the only film you make. I cannot wait to see what comes next. That is my time
Thanks so
with you
much.
today. Thank you both so much for chatting with me, and congratulations. The movie is just breathtaking.
Thank
Thank
you
you
so
so
much.
much.
Nice to
Thank
speak to
you.
you.
All right, that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find more of some of the stories that we mentioned at slashfilm.com. I will link to a bunch of stuff in the show notes as well. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to check out patreon.com/popculture to hear more from many of the folks that you heard on this episode. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. We would love to hear from you. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really helps us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show if you can. If you listen to the show, if you've been listening for a while and you appreciate what you hear, spread the word around. Tell people what's going on. We really appreciate that. That would help our visibility, which helps keep this show alive. Thank you so much for listening, everyone, and we'll talk to you next time.